I mean, there's so many management consultants nowadays who are trying to move into tech. And it's definitely more possible nowadays than it used to be, because I think a lot of them have created a path and tech companies are starting to realize management consultants are useful. But back then, I think it would have been pretty hard to join a Dropbox or something like that without any technical skills.
Hey everyone, I hope you all had a fantastic week and welcome back to Work in Progress podcast with Dana and Angela. If this is your first time listening, welcome. We're so glad you found us. If you're looking for career change inspirations or simply curious how some amazing people change their paths, this is the podcast for you. Each week, we sit down with an amazing guest who's been through major career changes, either to a different industry and or a different role. And we ask them how they did it. We share their lessons and experiences so you can do the same for yourself. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and follow us on our social media for more interviews like this. And now on to today's guest, Leo. Leo is a director of product at a tech startup, but he actually started as a management consultant. Over the course of his career, he's worked in different roles, different industries, and different countries. Not surprisingly, our conversation was filled with funny stories, adventures, and experiences. My favorite part was how he applied for Dropbox. You don't want to miss that one. I hope his story inspires you just like it did to me. Without further ado, here's Leo's work in progress story. Okay, so Leo, welcome to our podcast. It's super exciting to have you here. And you have some interesting career stories that you can share with us. So why don't you get started by telling us about the past and current jobs you've had, and we'll go from there.
Hello. Nice to be here. I started my career in management consulting. I worked for a small boutique consulting company out in Virginia called Dean & Company for about 6 months. After that, I joined Bain & Company in Australia, working in Sydney, Melbourne, eventually Singapore and San Francisco for about the next 2 years. I then left to start my own tech company for a year, joined Dropbox for another 2 years, became a product manager at a machine learning startup called EverString. And then moved on to Evernote. And now I'm currently at a company called Apartment List, where I'm director of product.
So you went from consulting to tech. So I know that here's a little question that I have. You know, you obviously had a pretty really good career before being in management consulting. It's a really good job. I wonder what your parents thought when you told them, hey, mom and dad, I don't want to do this anymore. I like my video games and, you know, computers and iPhones and tablets. So I'm just going to go jump into tech. What was their reaction?
My parents are Asian, so you can imagine they hated it. My parents really hated it, because I think in their mind, I was going from a pretty well-paying job with like good career trajectories and all that to starting my own company. And they were kind of like, what are you doing with your life? This is just an excuse for an extended vacation. But yeah, it'll be things like, oh, you know, so-and-so's son recently got promoted to manager in such and such company. You know how much he's making? He's making so and so much. And then you're like, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that must be tough.
And just out of curiosity, I guess growing up, did your parents have any sort of expectations or, you know, any kind of direction that they wanted to kind of nudge you towards in terms of what you would be in the future?
I mean, they definitely had opinions, but credit to them, I think they did kind of let me chart my own path. So my mom used to be a doctor, so she obviously wanted me to be a doctor. My dad is a professor. He wanted me to be a dentist. Because
you're the farthest.
So dentists have like a really high suicide rate. That was not the reason. The reason is because dentists actually have a very stable job and they get paid a lot. So my dad was like, go be a dentist.
Yeah.
So I actually did. I almost did. I went and I took the test. And before they accept you, they make you do like these hands-on stuff. So like you have to bend a wire in a certain shape, and I'm terrible with my hands. So I didn't get accepted.
Interesting. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. And then we thought about being a lawyer as well. Mm-hmm. So the funny thing is when I was applying out of high school, I actually applied to, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So I applied to university in the UK. I applied to universities in Australia, and I applied to colleges in the US. I must have applied to like 18 different places. And I got accepted into programs like law and actuarial science, double degree, or law and economics, or electrical engineering. And I ended up doing a liberal arts degree at Dartmouth.
Interesting. How did you decide on liberal arts?
So it was kind of two things. One was when our school alumni came back to our high school to kind of talk about their colleges. You know, you had your typical Harvard people coming back being like, you know, we're from Harvard. Our degree is so awesome. And basically every school's representatives kind of sounded the same. But the Dartmouth people came back and they kind of just had a slideshow of them having fun in campus and in the woods, because Dartmouth is in the middle of nowhere. And they didn't really talk about they were like, yeah, you're going to get a great education, but you're going to make good friends and you're going to learn how to think, and it's not about the degree. And that really appealed to me. So I think like that was a big plus point for Dartmouth. And then liberal arts was just because I kind of felt like my whole life leading to that point, because Singapore has a very they kind of have like a curriculum track. So from when you're probably 10 years old, they test everybody in Singapore and they start putting you into different curriculum tracks where, you know, you have to get a certain level of grades in order to take all the science classes, and you have to take all the science classes in order to qualify to be a doctor. So those paths like basically close to you if you don't get the right scores from like when you're 10 years old. And so I had gone down a very quantitative, very sciencey, very math-based kind of curriculum. And I realized that I was really good at numbers and really good at memorizing things, but I wasn't very good at the softer humanities stuff. And so I think liberal arts just really appealed to me. It was kind of like, oh, it's really about learning how to think as opposed to learning about specific subjects.
I see.
So was it right to say that you wanted to work on the things that you were not so good at early on in your life, or was that just something that you wanted to work on because you knew you would learn more?
Yeah, I think I've always had a very generalist mindset. And even then, I remember just being very conscious about identifying what are my weaknesses and then wanting to have a, you know, my dad is really smart, but he's like a typical nerdy professor. Like he's like kind of eccentric. He's brilliant at what he does, but there's parts of him where it's like he's not, you know, as normal as other people. And so I think I always wanted to be wanted to be someone who kind of just knew a whole wide range of different things. And so I always kind of very consciously sought out to work on things and get exposure to what I wasn't strong at.
Oh, I see. So Tell us how you decided to go from consulting to tech.
Ever since young, I've always been really into video games, like you mentioned. I taught myself QBasic, I don't know, back in the old days on like a Pentium 486. My parents bought me like a book to teach me Visual Basic when I was probably around 10 or 11. I built my own websites on GeoCities back in the day. So I was really into the tech stuff and really love video games. So that's always been something I was really passionate about. But out of college, I kind of, because I had a liberal arts degree, I did economics and government, and I did a bunch of philosophy courses. I was definitely not in a position to move into tech. I did management consulting instead. But always at the back of my mind, I've wanted to get into tech. You know, I'm a huge Apple fanboy and all those different things. And so, I don't know. It wasn't a sudden decision. I think I'd always wanted to move into tech, and it was just a matter of how do I do it.
Okay. So how come you never considered, you know, majoring in computer science when you're in college, or maybe you did, but you just ended up not?
Yeah, because I was really lazy. No, well, that's kind of half the reason. I took one computer science class in college. It was the intro comp science class, and I loved it. It was right up my alley. I did all of the extra credit questions. Like, you don't have to do them, but you can do them if you want to. And I would, you know, go head into the lab at 8 p.m. and I would work overnight on a problem until like 6 a.m. in the morning. And the sun would come up, and I would finally figure out how to, you know, code a undo paint program. And I just really enjoyed it. But I ultimately decided against pursuing that because for two reasons. One was I didn't want to work so much through college. And then I think the second thing was I think I was trying to plan ahead at that point as well, which is like, what kind of skill set do I want to pick up in college that would give me kind of a strong base once I graduate? And it was the same, I think the same kind of thought came through my mind, which was up till this point, I've been pretty specialized, I've been pretty technical, pretty quantitative. My weakness really is in business thinking and communication and convincing people and frameworks and thinking through amorphous problems. And so I kind of figured, you know, I can probably teach myself how to code after I graduate if I really wanted to. But you don't really get to learn about philosophy and about international relations or political theory once you graduate. So I optimized for that.
Okay. So when you try to switch into tech, did you run into any problems? Was it hard? And how did you overcome those difficulties?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I switched into tech was I ended up starting my own company. So I kind of cheated. I hired myself into tech because I kind of knew. I mean, there's so many management consultants nowadays who are trying to move into tech. And it's definitely more possible nowadays than it used to be, because I think a lot of them have kind of created a path, and tech companies are starting to realize management consultants are pretty useful. But back then, I think it would have been pretty hard to join a Dropbox or something like that without any technical skills. So for example, after I started my own company and I joined Dropbox, at that point when we were hiring management consultants, having a technical background was actually a prerequisite. So you probably wouldn't have even made it to the interview without having that kind of a background. And so I started my own company for two reasons. One was I had an idea I really wanted to pursue, and I didn't want to have any regrets. I've always been pretty entrepreneurial, and I always wanted to be my own boss. And three was, I mean, I struggled with the decision because you are giving up a pretty stable, solid career track to do God knows what. But I ultimately decided to do it because I kind of just asked myself, what's the worst thing that could happen. The worst thing that could happen would be, you know, I'm not going to starve to death. I could always go back and work in management consulting or go work at another company. The worst thing that would happen would be if it fails. I learn what it's like. I don't have any regrets. And I have a really interesting story and a technical background that would ease my transition into a tech company. So kind of made sense.
That's really awesome. I think it's almost, it's very interesting to think about what you decided to do, both starting your company and transitioning to a different industry with no previous experience. It's almost like you picked the hardest thing to do, like almost like, you know, you're a beginner skier or a snowboarder and you wanted to go to Double Diamond on the day when there's a lot of snow and with no help, I guess, when with no one, you know, none of your friends going with you. So tell us, what were some of the fears or maybe uncertainties in your mind, anxieties or anything that you were really thinking that, oh gosh, maybe there's a chance that I won't make it?
I mean, the nice thing about starting your own company or making a career transition versus trying to do a double diamond, black diamond without knowing how to ski is that pretty unlikely that you'll die in the first scenario. The second scenario, you might not make it out alive. So, you know, the worst case is not that bad. I would say making the decision to do the switch was less difficult. Just because in San Francisco at that point, it was kind of the height of startup fever. Everybody was doing it. So it was socially pretty accepted here, even though my parents hated it. My friends were pretty supportive. I enjoyed the work. Like I said, I kind of thought through it and the worst wasn't that bad. I think the most difficult thing was actually in the midst of working on my own company. It's kind of cliche, but a lot of people say, you know, it's a lot harder than, you know, anybody could ever prepare you for. And it's, everybody says that, and it's true. You just can't imagine how difficult it is until you go through it. And it's kind of like, and I think after Heiawana, which is the company I worked on, I pretty much was like so burnt by it. I didn't want to do my own company for many, many years. And it's only recently that it became more palatable to me again. And it's not because, you know, it's easier or it's better. I really just chalk it up to amnesia, because it's like drinking. You know, the night after you get hungover, you're like, oh, I'm never drinking again. And then a couple of nights later, you're like, let's chuck some tequila. Starting your own company is kind of like that, except it takes years to recover.
That's a kind of a long hangover, isn't it?
I think a lot of us have experience being employees, but not a lot of us have experience being employers or founders. So could you share some of your hardest or like worst memories, or, you know, what were some of the hardest things that you had to do that made your founder experience so difficult that you almost don't want to do it again?
Yeah, I think, you know, even nowadays I work in startups and the founders that you work with aren't perfect. I mean, no one's really perfect, but I always feel a lot of sympathy. Because when it's your own company that you're starting, it's even different from being CEO of Bain or CEO of like an established company that you didn't found. When you're leading a company that you yourself founded, it's extremely personal. If it doesn't work, if it's not successful, if it fails, it's really on you. There's no one to hide behind. You can't be like, oh, I inherited a shitty company. It's like, no, you had a shitty idea, or you were a crappy manager, or, you know, you had really poor execution, right? Like there's really no one and nothing to hide behind. The buck really starts with you. And that's very different from working for a company. Because when you work for a company, it's like, hey, if I made a mistake in my Excel model, or, you know, this case doesn't work out, or the thing that I released doesn't really succeed, You can kind of tell yourself it's not because of you. Oh, market forces were at work, or my coworker didn't really pull their weight, or oh, it's just like a mistake. Shit happens. When it's your own company, it's it's you. Like, something is wrong with you. You know, you weren't good enough. So I think that's the hardest bit. And when you're starting your own company, it's a struggle. 99.9% of us aren't like Mark Zuckerberg. We don't strike rich on day one. And so it's kind of many days of asking yourself, you know, am I worthy? Am I doing it right? What am I doing with my life? So.
So did you have people, I mean, how did you get over that? Did you talk to your friends, your parents? Did you know some people that were also in startups? So they kind of, you can kind of share, not necessarily the burden, but you have some people to talk to. Did you have that?
Yeah, I think that's all, that's the second part of starting your own company that's so difficult. I mean, I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. I probably could have spoken to a girlfriend or wife, you know. But being a founder is incredibly lonely because, I mean, think about it, right? Like you quit your job and you kind of told your friends, hey, I'm going to work on this really cool idea. And then everybody likes your Facebook post about it, you know. And then you go out for brunch with them a couple months later. You know, you worked really hard. You launched a new feature and the uptake just hasn't been great. And your friend asks you, how's everything going? And there's just this pressure. And what you end up saying is, it's going great. You know, things are going really well. You know, we launched a new feature. We're starting to see some traction. Because, I mean, no one wants a downer. No one wants to meet you for brunch and have you be like, I think I'm failing. Like, I think this was a huge mistake. I don't think I'm good enough to do this, right? Like, no one wants to hear that. And you don't want to bring that up. So I think, that's a pretty lonely experience from like a social point of view. I mean, for parents, my parents freaking hated the idea, so there was definitely no going to them. And when it comes to employees, like it's even worse. Like it's this really weird dynamic when you're a founder and you're struggling. You can't go to your employees and be like, yo, the feature that you worked on sucks and no one wants it. And pretty sure we're going to run out of money at this trajectory. And I'm having like an existential crisis on whether or not I should have even founded this company. I mean, no one's going to stick around. You have to be the one that, you know, shows that brave face despite them doubting, them being like, what did I just do? You have to be the one to be brave for them. And so, and you can't talk to your investors either, because then they're not going to invest in you. You can't go out to meet people. Like, you have to be very careful what you post and what you say, because like then like you can't get funding, people aren't going to join you, because no one wants to join like a struggling ship. Everyone wants to join the next Facebook. Back in the day, not anymore, but so it's very lonely, because the truth you try to keep hidden within yourself.
Wow, that sounds very tough.
Thanks. I just remembered all that, so maybe I won't start a company again for another 2 years.
Okay, so now that, I mean, this is like a couple of years back, so you've started your own company, you kind of struggled, and I know that you eventually decided to, you know, put it aside for now, and then you moved on to a different company. So tell us a bit about that experience.
Yeah, so I joined Dropbox as, I think, like employee 198 or something like that. I joined their business operations team, which is basically a team of like ex-management consultants, like a couple of bankers with technical backgrounds. And our job was to essentially go and figure out how to get shit done at Dropbox. So for example, at that point, they were just starting to sell into Dropbox for Business. And so the team was like, my team went in and figured out, how do you set up Salesforce? What kinds of metrics should you report? Like, what should salespeople even be doing? How should they be doing what they're doing? And so we were kind of the people going in and figuring out how you do things. And then once you figure it out, you kind of pass that as a actual role onto other people for them to do as their full-time jobs. So like, you know, you would actually be a salesperson for a month. And once you figure out, oh, this is how you would be a salesperson. Okay, let's go hire people. I'm going to write the job description and I'm going to train them. That was the transition. I remember the way I got my Dropbox job was actually really interesting because I looked up my resume and I emailed it to my friend who was working a couple of blocks away, and I asked her to print out a couple of copies. I walked over, met her downstairs. It was probably like 10 a.m. at that point. And I had also written down on a piece of paper the addresses of a couple of companies I really admired. So at that point, it was Yelp, Dropbox, I think StumbleUpon, Eventbrite, you know, a couple of those companies. And I just physically went to their offices and I dropped off my resume. And to me, it was just like, you know, you got to hustle, you got to do what you got to do, right? It's kind of the startup founder kind of thinking. But when I tell people this story, they're like, that's crazy. But luckily, yeah, when I dropped off my resume at Dropbox, someone called me back. And one thing led to another, and I eventually started working there.
So was it difficult for you to convince them, hey, I have this company that I started, and these are my experience. These are the things that I can do. And you combine that with your management consulting experience. Were these two skills, did they make a lot of sense for your role at Dropbox?
Yeah, I think I was lucky. I felt like when I saw the job posting, the job description on Dropbox, I remember thinking, wow, this is like perfect for me. Because you know, we mentioned, oh yeah, we need a someone with management experience background from a consulting firm, check. You know, should have like a entrepreneurial background, check. Has technical ability, check. There might have been like something about being multilingual or something like that. Or like, you know, has experience working internationally or something like that. And I was like, oh, check. Mm-hmm. And so I fit the profile really well. It was pretty lucky.
Okay, that's pretty good that you basically ticked most of the boxes that they were looking for. And so when you switched into the role, did you what was the job like? Yeah, like how did you guys, you know, come up with the questions that need to be solved, and you know, how did you tackle that?
At that point, my boss basically just assigned us to different things. He'd ask, what are you interested in working on? And then he would assign you to it. And I got assigned to kind of helping the sales organization. At that point, there were only 6 salespeople at Dropbox. Now there's probably like, I don't know, 1,000. And I kind of was I was basically the first sales operations person there. And I set up a lot of their processes and initial automation and dashboards and in Salesforce. I think that said, I think one of my regrets from back then was I felt like I didn't really voice what I thought we should be working on or what I wanted to be working on. For some reason, I was really timid. I kind of just worked on what I was told to, and I didn't really push for like, hey, I think we're not focusing on the right things. We should do X, Y, Z, which is strange coming from a founder. I can't really explain it, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, maybe you were just taking a break from being a founder, so it's kind of nice to not have to fight ideas so much. Sometimes it's, you know, it's just a different side of being an employee, I guess.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. So that was pretty lucky that this job turned out to be a pretty good combination. I mean, the requirement turned out to be a pretty good combination of what you had. And I know that in like, I think maybe a couple of years later, you moved on to a different company called Everstring and you were doing something else. Tell us a bit about that.
So when I was at Dropbox, one of the problems that we had was, We had very few salespeople, but we had a lot of people who were coming to us saying, I'm interested in Shopbox for Business, but I'd like to find out more. And so one of the things that I did was, you know, we actually have a lot of data on people who are emailing us or calling us or whatever, because most of the time they're existing Dropbox personal users. So I built the very first predictive model that would, I ran the analysis to figure out, okay, like when you, you know, have this many gigabytes of files in your Dropbox and you share it with this many people, and you know, you have this much activity in a single month, for example, that you're very likely to be a good Dropbox for Business customer. Like you're very likely to convert when you reach out. So I built essentially like a model that would dynamically score any person that would send in an email asking, like having a sales inquiry. And that was essentially the first predictive algorithm at Dropbox. At the same time, I was looking to do a transition into product management because I didn't want to really do backend tools stuff as much anymore. I really wanted to work with engineers and build features as opposed to working with sales and building process. And so EverString was a company that was at that time building predictive lead scoring, which is exactly what I had just built at Dropbox. And this was, what, 2013? And back then, you know, this was just a newly emerging kind of thing. Like no one was really doing it except a few smaller companies. So they didn't have like a bunch of product managers to draw from. Like AI, all this was really new. Machine learning was really new. So my experience really stood out. And I got hired as their very first PM right after they raised their Series A.
Yeah, I see. So back then you were new to this, the product management role. How is it different or similar to your past experiences? Was it similar to any of your past jobs? Like, you know, being a founder, was it similar to that? Like, did you have to put on your founder hat to think about things, to think about products in terms of in that way?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, the nice thing about being a founder is you get to kind of do all the jobs. So at some point, one of the jobs that you're going to be doing is going to be a subset of something you've experienced at some point being a founder, whether it be recruiting, marketing, you know, coding, product management, design. I think I mentioned all of it, HR, done all of that. So product management was, we never were big enough to have a product management team, but the concept I basically understood, which is there's someone who needs to figure out what you need to build. And that someone needs to work with the experts in their crafts, whether it be designers or engineers, to have everybody kind of move in the same direction and get that thing built.
So you said that as a founder, you got to do a little bit of everything, basically. So like almost every function within an organization. So you got to try a little bit of that. So what made you decide on, I guess, product management specifically? Because it sounded like your role at Dropbox, you were a great fit, but it wasn't something necessarily that you were looking for, but, you know, was a really good segue into a tech company as an employee. But what made you decide to pursue a role in product management specifically?
Yeah, I think for me, I really like strategy and I really like tech. So if you're a person who likes strategy and you like tech, product management is kind of the best place for you to be because that's where you influence the strategy. That's where you set the strategy and you're like, oh, we need to build this thing. So, you know, what drives me nuts is, or what I just do for fun is whenever a tech company launches a product, like even before I was a product manager, I would start critiquing or I'd be like, you know, really loving it. I'd be like, oh yeah, you know, this is such a perfect fit. It makes money. It solves a user problem. They're really clear about the segments that they're going after. Oh, look at that UX. It's amazing. The design is really awesome. And when you're working in sales operations or business operations, you're not building product and you're not setting the strategy for what the product should be. Someone else is doing that, and you're basically trying to help salespeople sell that product. And for someone who is actually pretty opinionated about product, that kind of was really difficult for me. And so product management was really a pretty natural fit.
So was it hard at all for you to go from doing what you were doing at Dropbox to becoming a product manager?
In some ways, I think in terms of domain knowledge, I think I had a fair amount. I was pretty, you know, familiar with Salesforce, how you develop on it, how it should work, what are the key things that you that a salesperson is going to care about and will want to see in a product. I think the main thing that I struggled with was the more day-to-day things about being a PM. So I can tell this now because I have now enough experience. But for that first product management job, they were like, do you know how to create mockups? And I had to do that for my interview panel, actually. It's like, I want you to create a mockup for what this product should look like and talk me through it. Like, and tell me, as a product manager, how would you run the product management process? And I had no idea because I wasn't a product manager at that time. Even though I kind of had the kind of-ish title of it from Dropbox. So I did a bunch of Googling the week before. I downloaded a program called Balsamic, which lets you make mockups, familiarized myself with it, did some mockups, and faked it till I made it.
So I've never heard of a mockup before. Could you explain that?
A mockup is basically where you draw out with just basic shapes and squiggles. So like, okay, you know, the interface, we should have a photo here and you should have a button there. And like, it's not, it doesn't look nice or anything. It's kind of just almost like you drew it at the on the back of a napkin.
Okay, so it sounded like you did your own Google research to figure out what a mockup is, and you came up with, I guess, a way to convince the interview panel that you know how to do it, even though you didn't really know. After you got the offer, what else did you do to really make sure that you're actually able to do the job that you promised the interview panel that you knew how to do?
I just did a lot of Googling. That's pretty much it. And I mean, the lucky thing was, I just knew a lot about the product that we were building. So I think that kind of just made up for that weakness. And then B, they were a really small company, so they didn't really know how to do product management. Plus C, product management is not a super defined kind of a role, especially back in 2013. Nowadays, there's like, you know, classes and all these different things that teach you how to be a product manager. And it's a lot more standardized. I think there's also a really strong understanding of Agile and Scrum. Back in those days, it was kind of, you know, anything goes. And so no one really could critique you and be like, oh, that's not how a product manager does it, because every product manager did it differently.
Interesting. So you kind of just... it kind of just took it one day at a time. It was kind of an intuitive process, but with a lot of thinking and planning.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, as a product manager, you're just trying to ship good product. And you don't need a course. That's what consulting taught me. You don't need a course to teach you how to do something. If you're good at thinking. And also what liberal arts taught me, right? It's like, you don't need to learn specific domain knowledge. Liberal arts is all about teaching you how to think. Mm-hmm. And consulting was really actually a furtherance of that kind of a skill set. So product, like being used to product management, was just really, okay, what's the problem I'm trying to solve? Engineers don't know what they should be doing. all right, what kind of process would help engineering figure out what they should be doing? And with some help of, you know, Google, you figure it out.
Okay. That's very interesting. And I would like to learn more about that. So let's say, you know, I don't know. What would be, is do you have any examples you could give us? Like, let's say we have this imaginary company that we're trying to sell people silk scarves that are, you know, at a more affordable price. How would you, if you were the product manager for this company, how would you go about this whole thing? Assuming that the company is at its very early stage, like they just found a manufacturer that would, you know, help, that can manufacture some nice quality silk scarves at a lower price. And how would you go about, you know, promoting this product?
It's slightly different because, you know, I work with tech companies. Okay. I don't think you don't have a product manager role for like scarf manufacturing.
Okay.
Or I mean, I think specifically, Dana, you're asking about how do you promote something? It sounds more like a marketing or sales role versus the product manager who probably would be designing what the scarf should look like, the size, the shape, and whatever.
Yeah. Or how do you, let's say you go and work at this company that sells a, you know, XYZ tech product. How do you decide on what the product should look like and how to price it and how to, you know, promote it, what kind of product it should be? How do you decide that if you don't know, if you have no prior experience in this industry?
Well, I do have experience working on lead scoring. So I kind of knew what people needed. And so I could kind of come in and be like, well, this is what we had at Dropbox. I worked with salespeople. This is how salespeople use it. Therefore built this product. And then you build it and then you get feedback from your customers and you iterate from there.
Hmm. Okay. So you build it. So you beforehand, you kind of know about the market already, and then you build something and then you get some feedback and you iterate.
Yeah, as a new product manager who wasn't familiar with how to build a brand new product, that's what I did. But nowadays, I know how to build a brand new product.
And how do you build a brand new product?
So that's kind of one of the things I'm kind of working on now. Again, I think it's a bit more of an art than a science, so there's no correct way. But the way I go about it is it really comes down to being really clear about who your company is trying to serve. So some companies, it's pretty simple. They just serve the customer. My current company, which is Apartmentlist, serves multiple types of customers because it tries to connect properties with renters. So you actually need to make both sides happy. But let's say a Dropbox or an Evernote, you just need to make your user happy. So it's just really one type of user. Or it gets more complicated. So for example, if you're selling Dropbox for business, there's actually different types of users. There's the end user and then there's the admin. But the general idea is like you first start from just being really clear about who you're trying to solve problems for. And then you go and talk to them and you try to look at their workflow, or you ask them questions, you maybe jog their thoughts with some, you know, mock-ups to figure out what are the pain points that they're currently facing. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, let's say you're the DMV, you know, your customer would be drivers of vehicles. So you go and talk to them to figure out what are the problems that you're facing. Oh, like I lose my car registration, or it could be the waiting lines are really long, or whatever that might be. And then you prioritize those problems by, you know, how painful they are. Are users willing to pay for them? Does it match what your company is trying to do? Because like, you know, if they tell you, I get hungry in the DMV, I'm not sure the DMV necessarily wants to turn into a cafeteria. So, you know, it needs to match what your company is about and your mission. And then from there, you kind of figure out, oh, this is the problem we really want to solve. Mm-hmm. At which point you start trying to look into how you can solve that problem. And it's not like a linear process. You're probably exploring a couple of different problems. at a time, and you're exploring a couple of different solutions at a time. But as you kind of build it with increasing fidelity, as you test it with your users, you start narrowing down on a couple that would make sense. And eventually, if you're clear about what you're trying to achieve, who you're trying to achieve it for, as you test, you'll get more confidence and you'll be able to pick something.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in 2013, you were quite literally a self-taught product manager in a company where you were the only product manager. You learned how to do everything related to product. You didn't have, I guess, a lot of peers to learn from. And now 2019, you are a director of products and you're at company building something brand new. So tell us about, you know, what, I guess, what your growth was like in the last five years or so. And, you know, did you go to any other companies and how did each different roles in product teach you something differently?
Yeah, so I think at Everstring, I was there for about 2 years and we brought on more product managers. And as the company grew, I kind of also just learned better how to be a product manager. After that, I joined Evernote. And Evernote is actually pretty established. They have a really fantastic product design engineering team there. And I just paid a lot of attention to how everybody else does their thing. I mean, again, I think every product manager does their work differently. Even at Evernote, like every product manager has their own process. Even at Apartment List, every product manager is a little bit different. So there's no right or wrong. But what I made sure of is I would just pay extra attention to what people are doing right, and I would try to learn from that. We also had agile training. So the thing is, when I joined Evernote, they didn't know what agile was. They weren't really following agile process either. Just to give you a sense of how actually no one really knew what they were doing. So it's not like I was starting.
This was in 2015.
This was 2015, or 2016. So I didn't know what I was doing, but it kind of felt like no one else really knew what they were doing either. You basically just need to learn really quickly. I don't really have a better answer than that.
I had a question.
Oh, one more thing. I think what makes a product manager successful is less around being able to write the perfect tech spec or being able to follow agile flawlessly. I mean, all of that is of course really helpful, but those are more like good habits and good skills. But at the end of the day, what makes a product manager great is they're able to be very nimble and be able to solve the problem that their team is currently facing. Because as a product manager, the problems you're trying to solve are always changing. You're always working on a different feature. There's always a different fire in your company. There's always a process that's broken somehow. So it's actually really hard to, you know, it's not like making a burger where it's always the same thing. It's really about versatility. And I think that's where it's actually kind of friendly to people who don't necessarily have that background, as long as you're very agile, no pun intended, in how you solve problems, you should be able to go a pretty long way.
That's great to know. Okay, so I have kind of a fun question that I like to ask people for the purpose of our blog, because we like to kind of study how people transition their careers and try to, you know, like in hopes that everyone else who listens to the podcast or read our blogs can learn from these people who successfully switched. So the fun question that I usually ask our guests is that now that you were, so that you were previously a management consultant and you switched to starting your own company and now you're a product manager. So with all these years of experience working in, you know, different fields, doing different things. With all these experience combined, what do you think in the future you could do with all these? What could you transition to? Let's say you want to transition to something different. What could that be?
I think for me, at least based on my experience, you know, going from being really, I think there's kind of a general theme to my life, which is I went from being, you know, kind of pre-med in high school to going to liberal arts where I didn't know anything about liberal arts, to going to consulting where I didn't know anything about consulting, to going to starting my own company where I taught myself how to code and taught myself how to build my own company, to going to product management, going to business operations at a tech company, kind of helping Dropbox develop their initial sales processes, to then joining product management. I think my whole life, every stage has been doing something I had no idea how to do and just figuring it out along the way. So I guess my take on your question is it's less around the hard skills enabling me to do some sort of like a new career. It's really about just continuing to build that skill set of just being extremely versatile. So I feel like, I know this sounds really arrogant. I feel like for many different types of careers, I can probably go in and do a pretty decent job at it. Maybe I don't think I can slot in at the highest level, but I can probably slot in at like, I can definitely slot in at the entry level, and I'm pretty sure I can work my way up.
So it sounds like you're generally or overall a pretty confident person, but in the Silicon Valley, or I guess maybe being a woman myself, I feel like a lot of people I know, most of them are women, not all of them suffer from imposter syndrome. And what do you have to say about, you know, imposter syndrome? Do you feel like you at times have that too? And I don't know, what would you say to encourage people who tend to feel that sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I come across maybe in sounding really confident in this interview, but I think I think maybe last year was a pivotal year for me where I actually felt for the first time, no, that's not true. I still feel imposter syndrome. And I like felt it to a huge degree when I was switching careers, because I literally was an imposter. It's like, I didn't know how to do product management, but you know, I was trying to pretend like I did. But, and I mean, everybody says this and it's true. I think I'm living testament to it. No one else really knows what they're doing either, because if they did, they would have called me out straight away. And I think everybody's struggling, with getting something done. Cause I think it depends on your role, of course. Pretty sure you can't get away with being an imposter as a doctor. But nowadays, in sort of the problem solving kind of jobs, of which there are many out there, that's kind of like this, where you can teach yourself and figure it out pretty quickly. People end up by nature kind of working on very different things every day. Because think of it this way, like in a career that requires a lot of education to be able to qualify. So for example, lawyer or maybe a doctor. I would say in a way, like the variety of things that you work on, I would argue would be a little bit more constrained, because those are things that you're literally being trained to be able to do. Whereas when you have roles which are maybe like marketing, you know, you could or product management, the problems are so amorphous and so often changing that it's actually really hard for, especially at the entry level, for anybody to be specialized to a degree where it's really going to be noticeable that you're not familiar, because things are changing so often and the job is so variable that it's really impossible for even someone with experience to really know what they're doing all the time. So that's the thing that I would just recommend everybody tell themselves, which is even the people who have been doing your job for 3 years more than you are, they're probably working on things that they haven't worked on before and they're trying to figure it out. So you're not really all that different. You're not really all that much more of an imposter. Embrace it. You're going to feel it. I felt it. But fake it till you make it.
Thanks. Do we have any more questions? Oh, yes.
Just because product management, I feel like, has become like one of the hottest jobs in the market in the last few years, I feel like I want to dig in a little bit. What do you, what are some of your, you know, best advice for people that are trying to break into product management right now, knowing that the market is probably a little bit more different than, you know, when you did it in 2013, because there's probably a lot more structure, a lot more people that have been doing it for a while, and a lot of more people trying to break into it?
I think it's really hard to break into any new job, not because you can't do it, but because it's hard for your interviewers to be able to assess your ability, and therefore in the interview, and therefore they rely a lot on crutches like past experience, even though I think it's been proven that a resume isn't necessarily the most accurate, or even an interview, the accurate assessment of ability. So I would say the hardest thing about switching over to product management is getting your foot in the door. And that means networking. I think, you know, getting someone who you know, who can influence the decision or go out on a limb and give you a go, that helps a lot. Because I think that's the biggest hurdle. Or maybe going to a company that you want to become a product manager at, and then making, you know, a transition internally once you've proven yourself to be a capable worker. That works too. One of the people who reports to me now, that's how she's made her transition into product management, by just doing a fantastic job at her role and us just being like, hey, we need a product manager. She actually is pretty familiar with the subject matter that we work on. And she seems interested in making the transition. So let's do it.
Great. So I guess I have one last question. You know, just curious about your long-term career goals. What is one long-term career goal that you can share with us? You know, specifically, you said earlier that the idea of being a founder is a little bit more palatable now. Is that something we can expect to see from you in the near future?
I'm not sure. I mean, you just dragged me mentally through all the torture. So, I don't know. I think for me, my career goal is actually to do something very different from product management. Again, I think my...
In what ways? Different in what ways?
Just completely different. And like maybe similar in the ways that you're solving problems, but pretty... I don't know. I have a niche to switch out of the product management career track at some point, just because I really do think my life has been very consistent in the decisions that I've made, which is a career switch after career switch. And I think that mine from product management is coming along pretty soon. Because, you know, once you hit director of products, it's pretty hard to keep going up. And, you know, I think the next thing I want to work on is maybe more nonprofit oriented. I feel like after helping salespeople figure out what leads they should be working on and, you know, various different things, I feel like Silicon Valley sometimes just ends up being a little too focused on what makes money. And I think there's a lot to offer, and a lot of people who need help that aren't getting help today.
Do you think it'll be tech related?
Probably. Maybe we'll solve it in a techie way. But yeah, I'd love to get to a point where I'm a little bit more financially stable so I can start making some less financially responsible, but maybe more socially responsible decisions for my career.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. Well, so it was great talking to you today. Thanks for popping in and answering some of our burning questions. If people are interested in getting to know more about you, where can they find you? I know that you have a blog where you share interesting thoughts and, you know, some of your social media where can people find you?
Yeah, I have a blog where I write random things. The last post I wrote was about Singapore and how they've recently been building these really crazily amazing and futuristic gardens, and how I think they pay for it by relying on immigrant labor. And that website is leosnotes.com, leosnotes.com. So you can find me there. You can find me on LinkedIn, Leo Gong. Yeah, I have a gram. I have the gram, but I'm not very good at the gram, so I'm not going to share my gram. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for stopping by. It was really nice to talk to you and kind of learn a different side about you. Thanks.
Welcome. Thanks for interviewing me.
That's it for this episode, and thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe for more interviews and check out our other social media for more content. We are on Medium, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find all the links in our profile. Leave us a message, tell us what you think and what you want to hear more of. Once again, thank you for listening, and I hope this inspires you to be the change you wish to be and pave the way for more fulfilling careers. Good luck.